Hello and welcome to Should I Love This Comic?
My name is Damien Drouet-Whiter.
And my name is Irrigail Drouet-Whiter.
And with us is Mr. Bumble, the little black cat, which will be very significant today, because today we're talking about Sandman issue 18. It was cover dated August 1990, and it was on sale on the 3rd of July 1990. So just after my 16th birthday and just before.
My 15th birthday.
Your 15th birthday, very close before, in fact.
Toy boy.
Oh, you were, yes. And it's called A Dream of a Thousand Cats. Not that we could ever get 999 more of you, Mr. Bumble.
No.
We should announce to everybody that we are recording in front of a live studio audience of one black cat.
I'm not quite sure what his expression is.
At the moment, he seemed to be ignoring us because we're talking quite loudly and he doesn't like that. So, let's talk about this comic. Now, let's start with, as I'm sure you all know by now, on Should I Love This Comic, each episode we go through a comic from my collection.
Mm-hmm.
I've been collecting comics all my life and I try to convince Irrigail that it's a good comic. We kind of review it and do it. And I'm sure loads of you know that recently Sandman's been in the news a bit.
Has it? Gosh, I didn't know that we'd spent 10 hours, was it, watching Sandman?
I think it probably was about 10 hours, yeah, slightly under. But yeah,
in one weekend.
Netflix did an adaptation of Sandman of the comic book.
They did.
And it went up to The End of the Doll's House, which was issue 16 of the Sandman comic.
Okay.
2 months before what we're on. Oh. And issue 16 was also my first ever issue of Sandman when I first started collecting it as a kid. When I was 16, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are looking at issue 18, which is my third issue. And we were like, oh, we're going to be able to talk about it. No adaptation and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then this morning, I went on social media in the morning.
As you did.
And there was an announcement, a surprise announcement, that Netflix are dropping 2 extra episodes of the series.
Mm.
The first one about Sandman 17, Calliope. Mm-hmm. I think that's how you pronounce it. We'll find out when we see the programme. And then issue 18, A Dream of a Thousand Cats. So suddenly this podcast we've been planning, which we wanted to be timely and about something that's in the culture, is even more timely and in the culture.
For once. Yeah.
Yes, I know. That's really weird that that's happened. So our plan today is continue to do the podcast as planned.
Yes.
And then we're going to watch the episode and give a little review of that as well at the end.
Is it the first or the second episode?
It's the second of the 2 episodes.
Okay, so will we have to watch?
Well, we can watch both. It's a double episode, they said. So I think it's half an hour each.
Oh, okay.
So it's only an hour.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Not the end of the world.
No.
That's my understanding. I have no proof yet. I will know for sure when we get to the end of this. So, I like the fact you can hear Irrigail calling the cat up in the background of this episode, which is appropriate. So, this comic, Sandman number 18, as I say, it's from August 1992, is the cover date. It was on sale in July 1990, very beginning of July. It's called A Dream of a Thousand Cats, written by Neil Gaiman, penciled by Kelly Jones, inked by Malcolm Jones III, lettered by Todd Klein. The colourist was Robbie Bush. Although, when we talk about things later on, he's not the only colourist on this book. The assistant editor was Tom Payer, and the editor was Karen Berger. The cover art and the logo design was by Dave McKean. So usually I start these episodes by talking deeply about the careers of the people behind it, you know, and what was going on in comics at the time. I'm going to do a bit of that today, but I've done slightly more shortened versions, because really I want to talk about what was important about their influence on comics, more than going over their entire career.
Mm.
So we start with the fact that Neil Gaiman has had a giant career.
Mm.
you know, he's somebody who's known across multiple media. He's quite famous, actually, particularly on the internet, I think. And on social media, he's somebody who's known, you know, as more than just somebody who sits writing books. Mm. You know, he has quite a big media presence. And obviously, you couldn't help to encompass his career in a brief synopsis. But what I'm going to try to do is focus on his comic work, and in particular how that changed comics. So what we know about Neil Gaiman, he was born in November 1960. He was born in Portsmouth, England, where we've been.
We have been.
Yeah, actually in Portchester within Portsmouth, which we've been to. We went to the castle.
There's a lovely castle.
I don't think he was born in the castle, but I wouldn't like to promise otherwise.
There's not much of the castle left.
Well, in fairness, if he'd been born in the castle, that would fit in very well with Sandman.
It would.
It's very kind of Sandman-y being born in a castle. Mm. And he did move around a little bit as a child because his father worked in PR for the Church of Scientology.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's very big quotation marks around the word church.
Mm, yes. Huge. You can see them from Mars.
So, you know, I think his early stuff, when you read about his life, he doesn't talk too much about that, but I think there was always a certain amount of the outsider because they were moving and going in and his heritage was kind of Jewish but also Scientologist, so he was very much outside of everything.
Okay.
I think particularly, you know, in the 60s and 70s in the UK. I mean, you didn't move to the UK till 1979, I wasn't born until 74. Mm. But I can tell you it was very white, very Christian.
But they also, yeah.
At that point, and I suspect he would have felt like more of an outsider than other people.
But when the Scientology was quite big back then? Big for a...
I mean, they're big for a minority church, but it's still unusual, and it would have set you out as a difference at a school. Mm. And there's actually talk on his Wikipedia page, and again, you never know quite how true Wikipedia is, but that he was thrown out of one of the private schools he went to because his father worked for the Church of Scientology and they didn't like that.
Okay.
I don't know how true that is. I do know he was privately educated. Mm. So he's a very different kind of person to a lot of the British creators.
Mm.
You know, British comics are kind of known for the vast majority of people being involved in them as being working class. At least up to a certain point. I think probably 80s onwards it starts to change in the same way that the arts have changed over the last probably 30, 40 years anyway, where it's harder to get involved in the arts if you're working class because of the financial ability you need to live for free. You know, which used to be something you could do relatively easy as a working class person in the UK and isn't as easy anymore. So by the time you get to the early 80s, he's working mainly as a journalist, mainly writing articles and reviews for various British newspapers and magazines. And through this, he's kind of getting quite a wide range of people that he's meeting. So he's meeting writers, he's meeting comics people, he's meeting musicians. And he's kind of in this kind of creative community in London. And one of the people he meets through this, very significant for us, is Alan Moore. And in many ways, Alan Moore is the opposite of Neil Gaiman, but also he's the person that Neil Gaiman interprets more. You know, and I've seen some people recently talking a lot about how Alan Moore's stuff was always really political. Whereas Neil Gaiman, it's political, but it's the personal politics. So it's the stuff that's become bigger nowadays, the kind of, you know, having almost culture war kind of politics. But in the 80s was seen as safer. You know, at a time when he came through, a lot of comics, you know, the Hellblazer that was coming out exactly the same time, written by Jamie Delano, was very directly anti-Thatcher.
Right, right.
Whereas the politics within Sandman is much more just like, oh, gay people exist and they can be good or they can be bad.
Yeah.
You know, non-binary people exist, trans people exist. It's a much more kind of gentler way of being left-wing, I think. And sometimes people question whether that's truly left-wing, but anyway. So we've got this thing where he's coming up in this way, and he's very different from Alan Moore. So people consider him a protege of Moore, but it's not really true. But there are two significant things Alan Moore did. Number one, he showed Neil Gaiman the first comic strip script that he'd ever seen. Mm. So obviously people read lots of comics, but they don't necessarily know what the script looks like. Because mm-hmm. you don't see the script, you see the finished comic. Mm. And then the other thing he did was he read the first couple of scripts mm. that Gaiman wrote and went, oh, that one's not good enough. Oh, you're getting there. Mm. So he kind of encouraged him. And then I suppose he did three things, because he also mentioned his name to Karen Berger at DC in the mid-80s when she was looking. She'd been made British liaison. I think we've mentioned this before in some of the other comics we've talked about, that Karen Berger was the British liaison. Her job was to find British writers and artists to work with. Mm. And obviously, Alan Moore was the first one, so she's like, well, the first writer. So she's saying to him, well, who else can I approach? Mm. And apparently Neil Gaiman was in that list. Mm. But sometimes this is presented as, you know, Alan Moore was was his mentor.
Mm.
And that's not the same as saying, oh, you should try this writer, you should try that writer. And apparently, you know, it sounds like the truth of it is Alan Moore mentioned something like 20 writers.
Mm, mm.
And just Neil Gaiman happened to be on there. Now, one of the things this did, though, is it meant that Neil Gaiman met Karen Berger, who was an editor at DC from the 80s through to the noughties. Mm-hmm. So she was someone who was there a long time. And she was the British liaison. Now, it took a long time for things to develop, for series to develop and get launched with mm. DC. Mm. But in their first meeting, they talked about two ideas of Neil Gaiman's. One of them was Black Orchid, which was a limited series that came out just before Sandman. Mm-hmm. And the other one was Sandman. But from the sounds of it, there was something like 3, maybe 4 years between their first meeting and these being published.
Mm.
So actually, people often think Neil Gaiman did this, then this, then this. And actually the order stuff came out wasn't the same as the order it got involved.
Mm. Mm.
So, you know, his first comics for DC were kind of in about 88-ish.
Mm.
But he had been working with them for a bit longer. And actually, he apparently got commissioned by DC before he did any work for 2000 AD.
Okay.
You know, and in part, he went to 2000 AD saying, oh, I've been commissioned by DC, can I write a short story for mm-hmm. you?
Mm-hmm.
So his career doesn't necessarily go in the order people think it does.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd had one kind of mini hit before any of his DC stuff came out,
mm-hmm.
and that was a series called Violent Cases, which were, well, not a series, it was a graphic novel. And it was illustrated by Dave McKean, who does the covers and the design for Sandman. And it was quite successful in the way that a small press comic released in the UK would be successful.
Mm.
It's since been reprinted, and I think lots more people have read it, and it's a very good story. But it's also very interesting in the fact that it's a story about somebody telling a story,
mm.
which instantly gives you Neil Gaiman's entire career.
Mm.
It's stories about stories about stories about stories about stories about story. Mm. You know, and storytelling is always part of the story.
Mm.
And the storyteller is often a character within the story.
Mm.
And I think that's quite important to know. But basically, he's come into comics in the mid-80s, getting to know Karen Berger, and the thing that creates Neil Gaiman, as we know him today in comics, is Sandman.
Mm.
You know, and what Karen Berger had been looking for, and apparently she went to lots of different writers for this, but she was looking for someone to do what Alan Moore did on Swamp Thing. So we've spoken a bit about Swamp Thing, but we've never read any of it together.
Mm.
And basically what Alan Moore did on Swamp Thing is he came in and he took this character that pre-existed for a few years and had certain ideas attached to it, and he just looked at it from a completely different angle, when everything you know is wrong, and told a new story.
Mm.
And this is kind of what they were trying to get other British writers coming in to do, to look at the characters from a different way and tell a new story.
Mm.
And in some ways, this is what they were doing throughout DC in the mid-80s.
Mm.
You know, you could almost use that as a description of what George Perez was doing on Wonder Woman.
Mm.
And he's not some British creator who's come in. He's a, you know, long-standing American creator who got involved in that.
Mm.
But it is, they're trying to get people to look at things in different ways.
Mm.
So, you know, what Gaiman did with Sandman is he took DC characters and concepts and married them to his own interests in mythology and storytelling to create a truly impressive and immersive story.
Mm.
And ultimately, the connection to previous versions of Sandman within the DC comics is very vague.
Mm.
And it comes up solely in the look of his helmet, which evokes the Golden Age Sandman, who wore a gas mask. And then there's the character of the Sandman within the story, the person who thinks they're the Sandman, which we've seen on television. In the television version, it was Jed himself thought he became the superhero.
Mm.
That's based on a superhero that Joe Simon and Jack Kirby did in the 70s. Right?
Mm.
So yeah, that's where he's using pre-existing, but a lot of it is his own. A lot of it is just taking the name and grafting something entirely new to it. And this is something that was going on a lot in this era. You know, a very similar thing happened with Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol, with Peter Milligan doing Shade the Changing Man, with... I can't think of any others, but there were loads. It was a thing that was going on, and it was something that was very popular, and they were looking for people to do. So obviously, the most significant thing... This isn't an obvious thing, actually. Take that back. So what I want to go on to talk about is what I consider the most significant element of his work with DC, which is actually not about what's on the page, it's not about the writing, it's about business. And the thing that Neil Gaiman did... Actually, no, to go back, I think we have to talk about Alan Moore. Let me go through what I've written first. I'm trying to get ahead of myself.
Mm.
So Alan Moore was one of a long line of comics creators who felt they'd been exploited by DC Comics. Now, this goes all the way back to Siegel and Schuster, who created Superman, but they were forced to give up the rights, and I think they were given something ridiculous like $100, which obviously was more money in the 40s, but it's not enough money for creating Superman. And he came into comics very soon after the fallout from Watchmen. And after Watchmen, you know, we talked about this in the Alan Moore episode when we talked about Beau Jeffreys, that Alan Moore felt that he'd been screwed over. That he'd been lied to, that he'd been promised things that he was never going to get because actually they wanted to steal his creation from him.
Mm.
Now, there are questions as to whether or not that's what they're doing, or were they just being a business, and businesses act in that way, and he was treating them as though they were human beings, not a business. Now, coming into that, and with a career as a writer outside of comics, what Neil Gaiman was able to do, it's because he had other income streams. He could negotiate in a harsher way than other comics people because, you know, at the same time he's creating Sandman, he's co-writing Good Omens with Terry Pratchett, which he's getting paid for. He's writing articles. He doesn't need the money from comics. If they threaten to fire him if he asks for something, well, he can walk away and do other writing. So he used that to negotiate good terms for himself and his co-creators. And actually things that DC didn't normally give. Now, some of this is not just down to him, it's down to history. You know, they had just lost Alan Moore. And there were certain other creators who were saying, I'm never going to work for DC again because of what had happened. And I think they were wise enough to realise we need to give a bit more. You know, we have to have things. So amongst the things he did, obviously, is get them to agree that they couldn't use any characters he co-created without his permission and without his involvement, which is a huge thing. You normally, once you create a character for DC, if you're not writing that book anymore, anything can happen. And Gaiman has always been involved beyond. If somebody wanted to use one of his characters as a guest in a different book, they needed his permission, not just DC's permission. And obviously this is why he's involved in the adaptation as well. You know, he set it up from the start that they couldn't do anything with his characters without his involvement. Now that made a huge difference both to his ability to control his own work, but also to the comics industry overall. It brought creative rights to attention. It meant that the company started doing things they hadn't done before. Now, they have started doing less than they were doing in the 80s, but at the time it was like an opening up before a closure, you know. And it also meant that as Sandman was reprinted, and because it was written in a way where he expected it might get reprinted, because they knew about Watchmen, and Watchmen was already being reprinted forever and has never stopped being reprinted, he made sure that they all got money for it. So him and Sam Keith and Mike Dringenberg, and even Dave McKean, who does the covers, he got a royalty. And cover artists never got a royalty. So that was part of what was going on right from the start. And I think that's where Sandman changes comics. in the business side. Now, obviously, to focus on that makes it seem like I'm downplaying his talent, Neil Gaiman's talent, and that's definitely not my intention. He is a very good writer. He writes good comics. He's got visual ideas. He writes good stories. His characters work and they're consistent, but his biggest impact on how comics are made was not about the writing. You know, there is an element where everything he wrote, he turned into a fantasy book. Comics didn't suddenly become filled with fantasy books. There were more than there were before Sandman. But it was more about creators going, no, I want more of the pie. I want, that was how he changed things. So yeah, but he's still considered a great writer. Ultimately, most of his success has been outside of comics, though, and it's his writing, particularly the book American Gods, which really launched him to another level, became a bestseller in the US as a novel, which then obviously has been a TV series and has been comics and everything else. And he's still a huge comics writer. If he's ever going to write a comic, it will be a bestseller, whatever it is. That's my bit about Neil Gaiman. Did that make sense, what I said?
Yeah, it did.
So really I'm saying I think he's more interesting for how he shows us what was happening at that time in comics, almost than these comics, even though they're very good. And it is very interesting. I think he's one of those people, it's a bit like Stan Lee in a way, that you ask people outside of comics to name comics writers, they would come up with Neil Gaiman and Stan Lee. Now Neil Gaiman barely ever writes a comic. And for the last, 40 years of his life, Stan Lee barely wrote a comic. I mean, the difference would be Stan Lee did much more comics before he moved outside of comics. But still, it's interesting that people who are in the cultural kind of mind's eye as comic writers don't write very many comics. So let's move on to the artist. We'll talk about Kelly Jones. Now, Kelly Jones, he's an artist who started coming to prominence in the mid-80s. He worked initially at Marvel, and he was first off an inker. We've talked about this a lot with comics, haven't we? A lot of the artists we talk about, they do some inking, and then they become a penciler, and then sometimes they end up doing it all because that's what they want to do. And that's kind of what's happened with Kelly Jones. You know, if you go from him, he started as an inker in the mid-80s, he got some penciling work, then eventually, beyond Sandman, years to come, he ends up now where all of the work he does, he pencils and inks, and he always works with the same colourist. He's got much more control over it. You know, he's someone who loves, who draws really well. I mean, we know this. We've read the comic. So, yeah, his first work was on a toy tie-in called Micronauts, where he inked over the penciler Jackson Geiss. Very soon after, they cancelled that comic and they relaunched it as Micronauts The New Voyages. And for that series, he was the penciler. So he was the inker on the old Micronauts. They relaunched it with him as the penciler. After that book was cancelled, it only lasted about 20 issues. He worked on more Marvel toy tie-ins, but also began to do other work. Because I think, basically, once he lost his monthly book, he was scrabbling for work. And a lot of these toy tie-ins were 4 issues here, 5 issues there. So he was doing that kind of thing. But he was also doing work for First Comics, and eventually for DC. At first, he did quite a lot of fantasy stuff and horror stuff. He inked Mike Mignola on a book called Chronicles of Corum, which I think is based on Michael Moorcock. Michael Moorcock. He's the writer Elric, he wrote. He's like a fantasy writer who's very well known among those things. Okay. But I've not actually read very much of his stuff. But actually, he was also doing more pencil and inking at this time. He's kind of moving between DC and Marvel and First for a bit. And he did an issue of Grimjack that really stands out, that's really good for First. And at DC, he starts working with the editor Barbara Randall-Kessel, which, to link to what we were talking about before, she was the editor on Watchmen as well. So you're getting these links here happening across. And he did some issues of Teen Titans, and he worked on Manhunter, where he was working with Sam Keith, who co-created Sandman. So there was a lot of linkages going here. But what he ended up doing was a Deadman serial. So the character called Deadman, who eventually I think we'll read a comic of, because there's some great Deadman comics. And he's very well known for, he was a 60s character, and the idea is he's a circus acrobat who dies, and then he gets resurrected. He's a spirit and he can take over people's bodies. And to everybody else, he looks like that person, but on the comics page, you can see this kind of white-faced man with a red circus performer's outfit on. And what he did, when Kelly Jones took that over, he really reimagined it. He drew it in a completely different way. And he basically drew him as a skeleton in an acrobat's costume. Really creepy looking. Now, this was in Action Comics Weekly, which is a book I loved, and this is where I first saw his work. And from that, he got to do a Dead Man series, and he started doing more and more work on horror-related titles because of that, I think. So he did an Aliens series, he did a Batman Dracula thing, and within that he also did a few issues of Sandman. And this is his second issue that we're looking at here. So Kelly, being on Sandman, Sandman was hitting its stride, you know. It's basically at this point that it's going to being like in the top 10 every month. It's a top comic book within comics, you know, and a very different kind of book to be a bestseller. And that was around about when Kelly Jones came in, and he took off. As someone who'd been in comics for about 6 years, he was suddenly the hot guy. And he did more and more stuff where he was doing these short runs that looked beautiful, really good stuff. And lots of graphic novels, and he's going backwards and forwards between different companies. Until he eventually, in the mid-90s, settled down, and he was the Batman artist on the Batman book for 3 years. And actually has one of the most highly regarded Batman runs of all time. It was 3 years in a row with the same writer, artist, colorist, letterer, you know, all the way through, and it was really well considered. And he's still considered one of the greatest comics artists of all time. I should mention, actually, you own one of his comics.
Do I?
Yes, because do you remember you bought that Frankenstein Alive Alive? The Bernie Wrightson drawn one.
Oh, yeah.
Because you thought the art was beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, Bernie Wrightson got very ill towards the end of that. And Kelly Jones finished it, because his art style has certain things in common with Bernie Wrightson.
Okay.
It's probably the biggest influence on Kelly Jones would be Bernie Wrightson.
Oh, okay.
And Bernie, and Kelly Jones was the replacement to finish that series when Bernie Wrightson became too ill to draw it. So, you know, you actually own a comic that you drew.
Ooh.
Already. You know, he's an amazing artist. He still does work today. You know, you can go into a comic shop today and buy a current comic by him. He's working for DC at the moment on a horror book. So next comes the inker Malcolm Jones III. Now, there's not that much information about him. He's someone who had very few interviews done. And sadly, he died very, very young. He died in 1996. And he worked in comics from 1987, so he's got a 9-year run working in comics as an inker. And often in those kind of roles, the interviews tend to be more kind of retrospective at the end of your career or later on. So he didn't get interviewed very much during his lifetime, which is very sad, I think. But what we do know about him, he was a graduate of the High School of Art and Design in New York. Very famous one, lots of comics people went there. And then he went to the Pratt Institute, which is an art school and architectural school, also in New York. He worked in comics primarily as an inker. He started with a book called Young All-Stars in 1987. He moved from that book to ink a book called The Question, which was drawn by somebody who also went to the School of Art and Design at the same time as him, Dennis Cowan, who's a great artist. And while he was drawing Question, he took on a second book a month and started inking Sandman. Now, his first issue on Sandman was issue 5 in 1989, and he inked it all the way through to 1991. Then he switched over to Marvel for a while, and he did lots of short runs. He never had a long run on a series again, and as I say, he died far too young in 1996. His artwork was beautiful often, and he had, when he died, he'd not long started doing projects where he was doing full art. So he wasn't just inking, he was penciling, inking and colouring. And I think if he'd lived, I think we would have seen real greatness come out of him. And I think it's a real shame. When it comes to the letterer, Todd Klein, I don't want to talk too much about him. We actually covered him in episode 3 of this podcast when we were talking about Dr. Fate number 7. Mm-hmm. He lettered that, but needless to say, he remains one of the greatest comic book letterers of all time. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that is needless to say, but he's really good. And he's good in this. You know, the special mm-hmm. lettering for Cats. There's the special Sandman lettering. Mm-hmm. You know, he never just gives you basic, mm-hmm. Todd Klein. He's always putting extra in, and probably more than he's being paid for.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the last person to talk about is the colourist, Robbie Bush. Now, he did most of his colouring for DC. His first ongoing series was actually Sandman. And he coloured Sandman from issue 1 to 18. So this is actually his last issue that he did. And he also coloured other series in the same era. So he coloured a Huntress series, a series called The Demon, and later on Babylon 5, which is the one I haven't read. But The Huntress and The Demon, I read both of them. In the mid-90s, he was part of... There was a series that came out of Dark Horse called Instant Piano. And it was kind of an anthology of lots of young cartoonists working together. And it had people like Kyle Baker, Mark Badger, Stephen DeStefano, Evan Dorkin, and Robbie Bush. So they were all writing, they were all drawing, they were all colouring, they were all lettering, they were all able to do everything.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, he kind of moved more into comics writing, his work within comics. He actually spent a long time from kind of the mid-90s through to the noughties, up to about 2010, writing... various stories for the Cartoon Network titles. So DC, because they're a Warner Brothers property, they own lots of cartoon things, and they used to do comics of them. So he wrote strips like Bugs Bunny, Flintstones, Powerpuff Girls, Scooby-Doo, that kind of thing. Now, he also did some storyboarding and animation. Harder to get an idea of precisely what he did from that, because often the information is a lot less detailed on who did what in animation. It's hard to cross-reference.
Mm.
But, you know, he's somebody who actually went from being a colourist to being more of an artist and a writer, which isn't that uncommon, really. So we've got this this team of great people here, and they're going to tell a story. Shall we go through it?
Shall we?
Yes. And it's A Dream of a Thousand Cats. Says she is here, but they must hurry. Directed to an open window, the kitten escapes the house and joins the collected curious cats in a graveyard. She jumps onto the head of an angel and tells her story. She was in the thrall of human beings, fooling herself into thinking she was in control of her life. And then she fell for a ragged tomcat. He was ragged of ear, dark of eye. It was my time for love, and he was my choice for lover. She soon gave birth to a litter, anxious to teach them about the world, but the humans disapproved. She was a purebred Siamese, and the kittens were worth nothing. The humans tied them up in a sack and threw them in the river. She realized then that while they lived with humanity, the cats would never be free. So she prayed and she dreamt. In her dream, she travelled miles in various inhospitable places to get to the Dream Lord's cave. There, the guardians of the cave tried to dissuade her, but she travelled in, only willing to speak to the Dream King. Finally, she got in front of him, a massive ink-black cat with glowing red eyes. She wanted to understand, why did they take her children? The Dream King told her to look into his eyes, and she saw what she believed was the truth. Many seasons ago, cats truly ruled the world. They were larger and humans were small. And the humans were even more fun than birds to hunt. Then one day, a human gained inspiration in a dream. Dreams create the world anew every night. So if everyone could dream something different, it would become true. Eventually, he convinced enough people to dream, and the next day the world changed to how it is now. Knowing this, the cat understood that she had to travel the world, telling the story to all the cats she could, in the hope that eventually enough of them will dream it into reality. As she goes to leave, the little kitten says, "Mistress, I believe. Then there is hope, child." On their way back to the house, the cats discuss, "Do you think it will happen?" "Little one, I would like to see anyone, prophet, king or god, persuade 1,000 cats to do anything at the same time." Back at the house, the humans eat their breakfast and watch their kitten dreaming. They think it must be hunting in its dream, some kind of small animal. Oh, isn't that cute? The end. Stars fading when I linger on you. Story to summarise, really.
Yeah, very much so.
I mean, there's a lot of writing in it and a lot more detail and stuff that I left out there, but essentially, very simple story. It's a cat telling other cats a story. The little kitten believes it and wants to change the world. What did you think of it?
I loved it. I really thought, like, I really, really did. Yeah. I think it's a really nice story.
It's very charming, isn't it, in many ways?
Yeah.
It's very... I'll be interested to see the adaptation later, because one of the things that I think Neil Gaiman does best is doing a one-off story that feels bigger than it is. He tells you, like, a one-issue story that's got so much more world to it. You know, and some of it's just choice of language, some of it's the ideas within it, but it just feels big. You can imagine that cats get together to tell each other stories. And also, I think it's making the that central point, you know, if enough people dream it, it can become true. In some ways, it's true. You know, if lots of people have the same dream, you can change the world. I mean, not in the sense of it reorders that it's always been like that, but if enough people want change, it will change.
Yeah, totally.
Anyway, should we talk through the kind of levels that we talk about? We always talk about five things. Should we talk about accessibility first?
Can we talk about accessibility?
Now, it's an interesting story, I think.
Yeah.
Because when I got you to read it, we hadn't watched Sandman yet.
No.
By the time we're recording this episode, you have watched Sandman.
I have.
Do you think that changed how you read the story?
Yes.
In what way?
Because what I discovered from the TV series and this is that basically I feel that you can read a Sandman comic in its entirety and there doesn't seem to be many questions that you ask yourself. They're stories within themselves without...
They can be. I mean, there's definitely issues where you would read the whole thing and you wouldn't read a complete story.
Okay.
There are serials within there where it very much breaks and then sets up again the next story. I mean, I think they can be satisfying issues, but they're not always this completely contained.
So this is completely contained, and
Actually, I think... One of the things I think works about this story is, for accessibility, is for this story to work, you don't need to know anything else.
No, if I'd read it, I wouldn't have necessarily gathered that the big black cat is Sandman.
No, apart from the fact that he's referred to as the Dream Lord or Dream Cat or... It's not important that... It's not important to this story who the character of Morpheus or Sandman or whatever you want to call him is in the longer arc of the story.
No.
It doesn't matter who he is in this story. This is a story about cats and owners and the power dynamic between them shown from the side of cats. You know, so really all you have to understand to access this is that there are cats, there are humans, and that one keeps the other as the pet. You know, which is a very clever way of telling a story. It's a clever way of drawing you in as well. I imagine a lot of people would give this to a fan of cats and get them to read it, and they would love it, and it might bring them into comics. So, I mean, for me on accessibility, I gave it 5 out of 5. What about you, darling?
Yeah, 6 out of 5. That's all. Yeah, top.
Well, we can only give 5 out of 5, unfortunately.
Top scores.
Top score. So next is artwork.
Yeah.
And artwork is where I want to talk about something. Well, both the artwork and when we talk about the cover. I want to talk about the different versions of this comic we have. So I brought the original one, issue 18, in 1990, which is helpfully being waved in the air by... Irrigal right now, which doesn't help at all on a
visual,
on a audio format. I also ended up with, and I don't recall when I bought it, but I have the Essential Vertigo reprint of this, which is from, has that got a date on it? Actually, I didn't write that down. January 1998, so okay, nearly 10 years later. Which is the same comic reprinted, but with slight changes. Particularly to the cover, which we'll talk about when we come to score the cover. And also we have, because Irrigal prefers to read comics digitally, you bought the comic on Comixology and read it online. And the art is quite different between the three. Particularly the colouring. And I talked a little bit before, I talked about Robbie Bush as the colourist and his career. But in a way, he's not the colourist of this book entirely. He coloured the original issue, and it was his last issue colouring Sandman. Then they started reprinting Sandman in collections. And for the collections, by the time they were printing them, they changed the colourist to a guy called Danny Vozzo. And he started kind of slightly adjusting the colours, making corrections. You know, an editorial decision was made to do that. And I think it's based on that reprint from 1998 comes from. So they've been slightly altered. And it isn't just within... It's not just technical correcting things. It's a bit more than that. Some of it's down to the paper that it's printing on being better quality. The colours are much more vibrant in the more modern version. They're in the 1998 version. They're much brighter, aren't they? Particularly once you get... If you open it up and compare, you know, there's a lot of dark colours in this. And they're not as dark in the modern version. And where there's no colouring and things are white, the white is starker in different versions.
Yeah. Sort of like, I mean, even if you look at...
I mean, I would say actually pages 2 and 3 is a real point of difference between the two, in the difference of brightness and how the colours have gone, and actually some changes. And this is between 1990 and 1998. And this is just slight recolouring being done by Danny Vozzo. Just slightly... A lot of it was what they considered to be correcting things that had gone wrong. But actually, they've done a lot more than that. And I think what I would like to do is put on our website, which is shouldilovethis.blogspot.com, I will put pictures of this two-page spread, pages 2 and 3, on the two comics and also on the digital version so that we can compare. But basically what they did is they got it kind of improved slightly for the trade paperbacks. Then in the noughties, they decided to do the omnibus, which was a big deal at the time, where they got the whole thing recoloured. And if you buy any of the reprints now, any of the new ones, it lists the colourist as Xylanol. And Xylanol is a company that's run by Danny Vozzo. So he recoloured the whole thing. So the version that we get digital, I think, is the completely recoloured. But there really is quite a lot of difference in colour.
They've even made a cat smaller, kind of.
No, I think it looks smaller because of the colouring.
No, just look, if you look at that one, and that one is definitely thicker.
But that's colouring. Actually, that one is a colouring error. If you look there, you can see there's an outline of the cat that hasn't been coloured white.
Oh, okay.
Whereas on the other one it has. So some of it is genuine, you know, mistake. If the cat's meant to be white, the little kitten is white. We should have mentioned this. Part of him was coloured over, so the cat looked skinnier than he actually was.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, there are errors. But then there's errors the other way. Oh, in the original, there's a tree there, and he's jumping out of a window by a tree. But you can't see it's a tree. And on that one, they change the colour and make it obvious. So it's worth looking at, but they've changed it quite a lot. For me personally, I prefer the Robbie Bush colour, the original.
Okay.
Errors and all. Probably because I read it first. But I know that the general belief is that the colouring got better once he stopped colouring it.
Okay.
And some of it was to do with what was happening in DC at the time. Because they were moving to computer-generated colouring. And Danny Vozzo, who takes over, was one of the pioneers of computer colouring.
Okay.
So that's part of it. You know, having gradients, having special things. You know, that's part of the change. But even though it's very different, I think both versions work. You can read the story either way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, you will have personal preference. You know, and some of it, I think, looks better in the original and... Probably similarly, I would say some of it looked better in the, you know, reprint. But, you know, I like this. One of the things I like about older comics is because colours are less vibrant, I think everything's a bit more subtle. Which I quite like. I think sometimes the vibrancy. Thank you very much for helping me speak English.
Right.
Which is your second language and it's not my second language.
No.
I think that sometimes gets in the way. But what score would you give the artwork?
5 out of 5.
Sorry?
5 out of 5.
5 out of 5. I also gave it a 5 out of 5. I mean, basically, Kelly Jones is a genius. Malcolm Jones III was a genius. And actually both Robbie Bush and Danny Vozzo are really talented colourists.
What I like about the artwork is it kind of, I think I mentioned this to you when I was reading it, was that it really does, the influences are quite they're not very subtle, so I think there's quite a lot of kind of Japanese art, kind of old art in there as well, with the cats and sort of like the way the stuff is kind of set out.
I definitely think there is some Japanese influence on the art of Kelly Jones. Not quite as obvious as with some other artists, but yeah, okay. I think it's in there. But I think for me, the real thing that stood out, and I meant to say this before and forgot about it because we were just talking in general, is, I think you can see that he was looking at cats.
Yes.
And I think that's really important. I think you sometimes get animals drawn in comics. But it's a bit like children, actually. There's people draw... A lot of people who draw comics can draw big, muscly people thumping each other and, you know, women falling out of their clothes.
But I think the cats are kind of... I mean, like, if we were to draw a cat, like, in the West, we would, like, do an outline, sort of, like, and then put hairs on it. So what they've done here is they've just put the outline of hairs, I think, on a lot of stuff.
I mean, in many ways...
Which I think is quite interesting and quite beautiful.
Kelly Jones stuff can be quite impressionistic. It's about light and shade and splashes of ink onto... white, and then the other way around sometimes, splashes of white onto black.
That, for example.
You know, yeah. There's definitely all the bits with the humans as well, where they don't have light and shade. It's all very open then. But I just think the fact that they look like real cats really stands out because so many comics artists I don't think would be able to draw this. I think this is actually quite a hard... And I think it's clear that they know cats. They've spent time around cats. They move like cats. Their expressions are cat-like. But they also fit the expressions of the storyline. You know, it is real genius stuff in there, I think. And actually maybe easy to overlook genius. You know, and I do know in the original reprint of it that I got, there is actually, you know, everyone does a dedication, and Kelly Jones's dedication is to his own cat, which I think is quite sweet. But yeah, I think it's, I mean, it's just genius work, and I think it looks really good. I think 10 out of 10 is perfectly right. Should we move on to characterization?
Yeah.
What would you give for characterization?
5 out of 5. I think I remember the various cats and...
Yeah, I mean, really, there's only 3 characters in it, I suppose. Yeah, maybe 4. There's the kitten. There's the older cat.
But there's motivated.
Who's taking, helping the kitten get to the meeting. And then there's the female cat who's telling the story.
But there's motivation, there's...
Yeah, I suppose you can kind of tell why they all do what they do.
Which is quite
And you've got like the innocence that kind of would believe anything. But it is quite broadly drawn. I would have gone a little lower. I would have that one. I'd give a 4 out of 5.
Okay.
And give that a 9. I think I don't think it harms the story, but I think it is significant that you get no idea of the character of Sandman.
Okay. Yeah.
He's kind of a blank slate.
But isn't he sort of like...
He's meant to be the embodiment of an idea, so maybe he's meant to be.
And I think also, sort of like, I think perhaps we should keep this for, so you know, for our harmony, but I think in the TV series, I think you get motivation of Sandman quite late on, or sort of, you don't really know what, apart from... wanting
You can't always tell what his... He doesn't have an internal monologue a lot of the time.
Yeah.
You don't know what he's thinking or why he's thinking it a lot of the time. And that is a significant part of it. And I suppose you could argue... I mean, you've not read the whole thing, you don't know the whole story. The thing you could argue is the key to this is that idea that dreams can change things. Dream is change. You know, which when you're talking about the base of the story being that everything has to be the same all the time, he's got responsibilities, he has to do things in a certain way, he can't change it. And then at the same time, you're sending the message that you can change anything. So that might feed into the long-term story, but in many ways it's just this little story. Which makes it a very satisfying comic, but doesn't necessarily... make you feel involved, I think, in the way.
Okay.
I think a lot of my involvement with this comic comes from me being a cat owner and having owned cats most of my life.
Yeah.
And loving cats, and therefore reacting to it from that point of view.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about the cover.
Yeah.
Dave McKean. We'll start with, this is one that's actually really different between the reprints. Mm. And I think it's very interesting. Dave McKean did the design for the original cover. He did the logo. He did the illustration.
Mm.
And then when they did Essential Vertigo, which was reprinting old stories, and basically what they did was they reprinted Sandman and they reprinted Swamp Thing, the Alan Moore Swamp Thing. I think that's all they ever reprinted. But it had that setup where there's a border and it says Essential Vertigo.
Mm.
But the bit in the middle is still drawn and designed by Dave McKean.
Mm.
But Dave McKean has changed it. They haven't just put the original cover smaller inside it.
Mm.
He's changed the logo. Mm. He's changed how Dream Country, which is the name of the series of stories that take part, place, the series of one-part stories is. Even how it says by Neil Gaiman, Kelly Jones and Malcolm Jones III has changed its font.
Mm.
And it's been changed quite a lot.
Mm.
And I think that's interesting.
So why do you think they went to all that trouble?
I think some of it is, I think the original layout in part responded to the side bit that had the price and everything, which wasn't going to be on this version. The new layout had to allow for the it's got a sticker over it, my version, but had to allow for a UPC box.
Okay.
You know, it had to allow for the fact that
there's
going to be a cutout in it, which wasn't in the originals.
Yeah.
So they had to allow for those two things.
Mm-hmm.
And then within that, you know, it's... I think Dave McKean, a few years later, has a slightly different design taste.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he wants... I suspect he went capitals instead of small letters, because then that goes with the Vertigo logo, the Essential Vertigo.
So yeah, so I've just had an epiphany. There you go.
What's the epiphany?
I think the sort of like so basically this is a broken border within the cat. So sort of like it's a painting, possibly, of a cat jumping.
I think it's definitely a painting of a cat jumping.
But the fact that the cat is trying to break out of the painting, I think, is a lot to do with the story, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's on purpose. So,
yeah.
Basically, I mean, Dave McKean does these kind of multimedia pieces, and again, you can see a picture at shouldilovethis.blogspot.com of both versions. But effectively what this is it's a painting of the silhouette of a cat kind of jumping out with kind of what could be sand or could be sun rays or light behind him.
Mm-hmm.
Her, I suppose, because it's the female cat from the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's within a frame, like a photo frame or a picture frame, I suppose.
Yeah.
And the picture frame has a dream of a thousand cats kind of embossed into it.
Mm.
And it's a real 3D picture frame that's been cut down. And I'm sure that cover, both versions of that cover, is a photograph of the picture and the photo frame together.
Mm.
And some of the difference will be the fact that what you can print of a picture will have improved. The colours are definitely brighter.
Mm.
The colours are brighter. There's... obviously, in the original, it's a bigger image, so the cat's more striking, and I think the cat's less of it in the second one.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's stunning, actually, and it does that kind of breaking out of your...
comfort zone, which is, I think, what...
Yeah, yeah, and breaking out of your borders, breaking the borders down, using dreams to break outside of reality, in a way. Is kind of shown off by the brokenness of that frame.
But it could also be tower blocks. It could...
Yeah, in a way, it does look like the cat's jumping over a city at the same time.
Mm, mm. It's a very clever
cover. It's very clever. I mean, Dave McKean is an absolute star. I think, as well, for me, the colour of the logo on the original, which obviously was not a choice where he's got a border. So he puts the blue colour onto the border and on the Vertigo logo. But I think that works very well. And personally, I like the fact that that kind of stylized S that he always put running over the Sandman logo.
Okay.
That's hand-drawn.
Okay.
Very clearly hand-drawn in the original. And it looks to me like that's done... It's, like, pristine. It's, like, done on the computer on the...
And then the second one, they... It's less there because they've kind of filled it in with red.
Yeah.
So, sort of, like, I was thinking that... So you say that that S is in all of them?
It comes and goes a bit, depending on the logo, but it's something... Okay. There's kind of an S in the background of the logo. The bit that stays all the time is Sandman in that logo.
Okay.
So that way, the S, the A, but the word the changes its font. And that stylized S that runs behind it sometimes does, sometimes doesn't. Sometimes he does different things with it. When they do the storyline, the next one where he goes to hell, it's called Season of Mist. And with that, they do a stylized S, which becomes the S of Seasons, and a stylized M on Sandman that becomes Of Mists. So he does lots of, like, playing. He's quite playful in his design. But that basic logo underneath it all stays the same.
So in my head, I was thinking that it was a claw, a cat's claw.
It could be a cat jumping over. I think it is just a stylized S.
Okay.
I don't know how long it took me to realise that was a stylized S, though. From originally reading the comics to, you know, at what point I realised that was a that wasn't just a pretty thing in the background.
So you prefer the original, do you?
I definitely prefer the original. I prefer the kind of handcrafted look. And I think... I mean, Dave McKinnon's done some amazing art with computers. He's able to use any medium to create art. But I do think I preferred his hand-lettered, his
hand-created
logos and stuff. And I'm sure computers were used in putting them together even on the earliest. But I think there's a spontaneity and a reality to that that works better. But then I can also see that the capital letters on the second one work better with the Essential Vertigo logo. They work better. It's having to incorporate other things.
Yeah.
So in a way, you do need to change it. But I prefer the original. But then the question comes, do I prefer the original? Because I've had the original 8 years longer.
Yeah. And even the little mouse. Is that a mouse?
I would have thought... I don't know, actually.
A dragon.
Is it? I think it might be a mouse skull or a rat skull. There was a thing, wasn't there, in it?
Oh, yeah.
Could be a bird skull, I suppose, because there's the raven shown as like a...
Oh, yeah.
...dead in the... when he interacts with the ravens.
So I'm probably going to agree with you. I prefer the original.
I like the original more. I think I prefer the vibrancy of the colour. On the second, because it's a better printing. But then the blurriness in some ways is more attractive. But it's just a beautiful cover. I mean, I gave it a 5 out of 5.
Absolutely.
So it's another 10. This is going to be a really high scored comic, I think. So the last thing we come to is acceptable in the 80s normally. Well, this was the 90s. Should we talk about acceptable in the 90s? Was there anything in here that would be unacceceptable in a comic nowadays but was acceptable at the time?
No,
definitely not. It's about cats.
It's quite difficult.
Well, it's quite difficult. Do you know what? I think it would be very difficult overall. There are things in Sandman that feel dated now. But compared to other works of the same era, it feels less dated. You know, there are certain things with... certain bits of terminology around the queer characters and the trans characters and that feel a little bit uncomfortable now that I think could be better. And, you know, on the stories where it's humans, you know, the big difference between the comics and the TV series is almost everyone's white in the stories about the humans.
That's true.
In the original comics. Whereas on the TV series, they've reacted to the world.
Mm. Mm.
And particularly as the two real places they go to are Britain and America.
Mm.
They are racially mixed places.
Mm. Mm.
So therefore, the cast are racially mixed.
Mm.
And I think that's been done exceptionally well.
Mm.
And you could call that a criticism of the comics, but not this one.
And they've also mixed, so, you know, sexes as well. So Lucien, you said, was a man.
Oh yeah, Lucien in the comics, who doesn't appear in this one, is Lucien now in the TV series. Yeah, I think that's the only gender swap of a character.
She's a good character.
I'm trying to think. She is a good character. And she works equally as well as a woman. It's that character, in many ways, is genderless in the comics.
Yeah.
You know, at least in the... I know there were some spin-offs that people did, and I suspect that in one of the spin-offs there was a romance for Lucien.
Okay.
But in the original comics, he is a character who has no kind of sexuality attached.
Mm-hmm.
Which therefore means changing his gender doesn't affect sexuality or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think... But yeah, we've basically come out... I don't think we're taking anything off for being inappropriate.
No.
So we come out with 39 out of 40, which means it's one of the highest reviewed comics we've ever done. We really enjoyed this one, didn't we?
Yeah, yeah.
So we're going to stop now. We're going to watch that, watch the TV adaptation later.
Mm-hmm.
We're probably going to have dinner as well. And then we're going to come back to you with our review of the new episode of Sandman on Netflix.
Yeah.
So speak to you later. Take care.
Thank you very much. See you later.
Bye.
Bye.
Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream. Make him the cutest that I've ever seen. Give him two lips like roses and clover. Then tell him that his lonesome nights are over. Sandman, I'm so alone. Don't have nobody to call my own. Please turn on your magic beam. Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream.
But Morpheus actually doesn't sleep very much. Because he's the king of sleeping. He's never asleep.
No, he's too busy.
He's too busy being awake.
Doesn't quite understand how he does them. Sort of like, I mean, so, you know, sort of like, obviously you say in the new, in the old one, he probably just walked into people's houses and their bedrooms and went like that and sent people to sleep.
Well, do you know what? The original comic Sandman was, I might use this for the episode instead, was just somebody went around punching bad people.
Really?
And very specifically, a lot of what he dealt with was he dealt with kind of Nazis within the US. It was in some ways quite political, but there were a lot of people who were doing that in the 40s in comics, you know, where it was kind of like, you know, it was the infiltration of extreme right-wingers in the US.
Yeah.
And they were fighting against it, and he just blew sand at people that made them fall asleep, I think. Was it sand, or was it a gas? It might have been a gas, actually. It might have been more... Because obviously the 40s, there was this thing for things being quite scientific in a way, even if they're not really. You know, like Batman's got all his pouches and stuff, so it's kind of scientific, but it's not really.
I'd be more worried that I got something in my eyes, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, he wore a face mask and a gas mask as well. Yeah, that's why he had a gas mask, because he was putting gas bombs. Yeah.
The people he was blowing it into.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't believe
it. It was gas bombs, that was it. So, yeah, the original Sandman was more, it was, he put people to sleep as part of his gimmick.
Mm.
That's why he was called Sandman. There was nothing else to do with dreams in there.
Mm.
It's just like taking the kind of idea. Then they turned that character into a more obvious superhero with a superhero costume in the 40s itself, and that's when they brought in Sandy the Golden Boy, who was kind of like a Robin equivalent.
Mm.
And then in the 70s they tried it again, this time Joe Simon and Jack Kirby did it, and it was a very superhero-y book. And it was the superhero costume that Jed wears when he says he's the Sandman, you know, in that bit of the Dolls House. You know, he becomes the hero in his dream. And he's wearing a superhero costume, and it's very much that was what it was. And, you know, big colourful costume, fighting against nightmares. It was much less... I don't know how to explain it, but it wasn't as... It didn't have a mythological bent at all. It was just the idea of somebody who was fighting against nightmares and on behalf of dreams. It was an odd thing. It didn't last very long. It was a very short-run series. And then it was picked up again by a writer called Roy Thomas, who we've mentioned a lot, but never read any of his comics. And he did a series in the 80s called All-Star Squadron. And in that, he took a character who... All the characters started off as the children of the Justice Society. So, like, Lyta Hall, who we know, she started off as the daughter of Wonder Woman, the Golden Age Wonder Woman. And she was called the Fury. And there was also Hector Hall, her husband, and he was the Silver Scarab. And he was related to Hawkman and was also kind of Egyptian-themed. And then he died and he becomes the Sandman and she goes to dreams with him. So that's kind of how he ends up in dreams, the character who's in there. And that was how they took the Sandman character. That's how Sandman was when Neil Gaiman came along. That was very, very recent. That series ended in, I think, 1987. They were in a series called, actually a follow-up to All-Star Squadron called Infinity Inc.
Right.
And at the end of that series, they get married and stay in dreams. And from that point, you know, that's where Neil Gaiman comes in.
Okay.
So then he just completely reimagines and makes him kind of in charge of dreams. And in a way, it's the kind of thing that very quickly makes no sense. How can he be in charge? Is he making everyone have their dream? Is he deciding what's in everybody's dream? Have they got no good role? There's a lot of, like, vagueness to it.
Yeah, but I don't think that's important.
No, no, and it actually... The story works even with the vagueness. You know, and the reality, they say that dreams went on when he wasn't there, so he doesn't have to be actively involved.
No.
He is involved. It's just interesting, I think, the way that it came on. So, we're talking about Neil Gaiman. Should we talk about the Sandman TV that we watched last night?
We shall, yes.
I am going to start by saying that I got lots of things wrong in what we recorded yesterday.
Did you?
Well, I said that, first I said the first episode was good. It was going to be a two-part episode, which was right. And the first bit was going to be Calliope, which I think I'm pronouncing correctly now. I pronounced it wrong. And then Dream of a Thousand Cats. And actually that was reversed. They reversed it from the order it was in the comics. So instead of going issue 17, issue 18, they went issue 18, issue 17.
Why do you think they did that then?
I think in a way, one follows on from the other better.
Okay.
I mean, for me, the thing I do not understand that they've done with Sandman is why they don't make these shorter single episodes. Why they keep turning them into...
Sort of double stories.
Yeah, they did it with a couple of... Like, with the the Sound of Her Wings, the death episode.
Yeah.
And then they married that to the Hobgadling, you know, the guy through the ages. And they made that one episode, and death's in both, and it kind of links. But why can't they be two separate shorter episodes?
I can't.
For me, I don't understand why they're making them all like almost an hour.
And I didn't see the link between, at least with the man going in through time and the death one. You could see sort of like a link, but I couldn't, like, as you say, the cat story and the sort of and the writer's story. Maybe they link sort of like eventually, but at the moment, there's no benefit to having them shoved together in a sort of like in an hour long
episode. I think, you know, Neil Gaiman would do these single issue stories between the arcs that he did.
Okay.
And this is kind of the first one where it's given an arc. So between the first storyline with Dr. D, John D, who's like, got the ruby and him getting the ruby back, between that story arc and the Doll's House, which were both in that first series, there were a couple of one-off short stories.
Okay.
And I would say, you know, one of those one-off short stories is the death one. One of them is the... But they weren't given an identity. What they did, when after Doll's House, they actually did a series of stories called Dream Country, and it had Dream Country written on the front of that comic.
Mm.
And they were one-off stories, but kind of, they're all stories that Dream is in, but they're not about him. And they're not about the ongoing narrative as such. And they're all individual stories of him helping someone in some way. So someone kind of asking for his help and him helping.
So do you think that there would have been a benefit with having just the arc story and then having the individual sort of like freestanding stories as a different series? Well,
I think, to be honest, I think that's why they put them in as bonus episodes.
Okay.
And actually, you know, the discussion always was, I remember when Sandman was ongoing, you know, and I said I started with issue 16, and I then read to the end, to issue 76. And very quickly, they were reprinting the earlier issues. I got the reprints, I'd read them all. By about issue 20, I would say, maybe 25, I'd read everything. And I was going to read everything. I was going to buy everything and read it all and know what happens. And there was always a discussion. At the same time, I'm like reading magazines about comics and reading letters pages. And there was always a discussion of, is he better at the short stories? Is he better at the long stories? And actually, the truth is, I think, that he's equally as good at both. And they both inform each other. And I think to some extent the short stories, the one-offs, number one, they let him go and play in a different area. But I think often it felt like they kind of rejuvenated him for a long story. And the long stories could be very long and very involved and very complex. So to then have like the palate cleanser. And in some ways, after what we've just seen, the Doll's House, and they kind of truncated it a bit in the TV series because they couldn't do a lot of the involved stuff that used the DC characters
that
we were talking about before.
Yeah.
With the old Sandman, they made that a bit more truncated. The Doll's House was quite a long epic story that was quite broad. So then to do some really like tiny little short stories, one-off issues, I think worked really, really well.
But those stories weren't sort of like, I mean, you say that they were shorter, but they weren't shorter on paper. They weren't shorter on paper.
They one issue. Yeah. Whereas Doll's House was like seven issues or something.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's shorter in that sense.
But one issue isn't...
No, all the issues are the same length, unless they do a double-sized or a special.
Like 22 pages.
Or yeah, 22 like. Pages was okay. The standard. The collector's issue, so the one about the serial killers, was actually an extra-sized issue that was a bit bigger.
Okay.
And it's noticeable that that was one of the ones where they didn't put two episodes together to make one episode of the series.
So what else did we get wrong?
No, we didn't really get anything else wrong, but it was that. But I just presumed it was going to be in the order of the comics.
Yeah.
And that I can't pronounce Calliope? I'm still saying it different every time. Luckily, that's not the half that we're talking about. We're talking about A Dream of a Thousand Cats.
Are we not going to bother doing the Calliope?
I don't think we need to. I mean, the fact that they put it together.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually, what we're talking about, the reason we're here is to talk about the comic, Dream of a Thousand Cats. Right. Let's talk about the adaptation, which was a cartoon adaptation.
It was.
Do you think that was a good decision?
Yes.
Yeah, no doubt. Cartoon was the way to go. I think if they tried to make it... The thing is, if they'd made it real, it would have been animation anyway, but it would have been animation trying to look real.
I was worried, and I think we've both sat soberly through Cats, the movie, the musical.
Ah, did you think they'd do it as like humans in costumes?
And I was worried they were going to go down that way, and we know what a... My life is away. So what?
It's an adult.
Is it? Okay.
Yes.
what an absolute shit show that was.
Oh, you mean the recent Cats movie? Yeah. I mean, they could have gone that way. In some ways, I think I would have enjoyed the kind of campness of that and the dreamlike quality of that. But actually, for the story to work, they have to be real cats.
They do. So, like, I mean, if you're sort of like, I mean,
it's not humans who think they're cats, it's real cats.
And if the comic had been like the stage version of Cats the Musical, then I think there could be some justification for doing it the way that they did it. They did the Cats, the music film, a film. But because they were quite clearly drawn as cats, then I think that any other way of doing it would have not worked.
Mm.
Now, I think you had issues with some of it.
I had some issues with it. I mean, I think you're right. The thing that was coming to mind for me there is the story is about the relationship between cats and humans.
Yeah.
So therefore, if you've got humans, obvious humans, as the figurehead for the cats, it kind of loses something.
Yeah.
So it had to be animation, you're right.
Mm.
I did have issues with the animation. I think it was exceptionally well done.
Mm.
And particularly considering, I mean, there was a tweet that it was like 20 animators worked on that.
Really?
Which for an animation is not very many.
A half an hour, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it was quite half an hour. Yeah. I think it was less than half of the episode.
Mm.
I think they gave more time to the bit with the humans.
They must have, yeah.
I think it was exceptionally well done. And some of the movement, particularly when they showed shots from behind of the cat, I thought was very effectively done.
Mm.
The issue I had, and I googled this because I didn't know if it was the right phrase, but there's a phrase, Uncanny Valley, which I've heard before, and it's this thing where something's almost lifelike but not quite.
Yeah.
So it becomes a bit freakish to you. And for me, I have a real problem with it. You know, Irrigale will know.
You don't like dolls, do you?
I'm not keen on human-looking dolls.
Mm.
I work in fashion. I dress mannequins as part of my job.
Mm.
I don't like mannequins with heads on. I like mannequins that are headless.
Yeah.
I find them less creepy.
Mm-hmm.
I think things that are almost human but aren't. And this time we're talking about cats. They were almost cats, but they're not quite.
So you would.
But even that slightly freaked me out.
So you would sort of like, and this is another topic of conversation that we had post. The episode last night, you would have liked them to have moved their mouths when they were talking. I was thinking telepathy.
I think the idea was my interpretation of the comic. And don't forget, I read the comic 32 years ago. You know, so I've lived with this in my brain for 32 years. And there's certain things that I've taken on that aren't in the comic but are in my interpretation of it. That's going to happen. My interpretation of the comic is those odd speech bubbles they have are kind of, the cats are making noises, but they're kind of translating those noises.
Right.
But they have got similarities to how telepathy is shown in comics.
I
suppose you could read it as they're kind of just, they're communicating non-verbally, but for me, my presumption is that if a human walked past that graveyard and saw all those cats there, they'd have heard the prophetess cat, you know, the cat who was telling the story, kind of going,
yeah,
you know, and it would have sounded like that to a human. I felt that their mouth should have moved somewhat, but maybe not in line with the dialogue, which then maybe that would have made it even weirder, so it's very difficult to say what I would have wanted. I think I'd have preferred it to be more obviously stylized as art. In the way that, and again, I think this comes from being a huge fan of the comic and having lived with that comic for so long. I want it to look like Kelly Jones's art.
Yeah.
Which it didn't. It had no. It looked like cats. But not quite right.
Right, the cats. The cats didn't look like the cats in the comics, but I think they got the
they were very expressive
color. They got the color palette right of the general kind of evening darkness.
Mm. I think the lighting was very good, actually. The cat. I think at the end of the story, when it's coming to dawn and the light's changing, you get this real... That worked very well throughout it. And you're right, the use of colour was very good. And in many ways was similar to the comic.
Mm. And they got...
For me, you know, you talked about loving the fact that there was an almost Japanese quality to the drawing. Yeah. That it reminded you of those kind of brushwork paintings that you see from the 19th century Japan. Yeah. You know, the kind of thing that came over to the UK.
So the cats couldn't have been...
You know, less of that, less... It felt less of a westernised. And I think the way they were drawn felt very modern and very westernised and very... Yeah. You know, when I googled the guy who directed it and did the design, the production design for it, he's an animator from Holland.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, from the Netherlands. He's a Dutch animator and he worked... it was done kind of digitally and remotely by... Dutch and British animators working together.
Mm-hmm.
And he's someone who's done a lot of animation and is known for a relatively realistic style.
Mm.
And it's a very different style to Kelly Jones. Now,
okay.
The difficult thing there is obviously if they tried to ape Kelly Jones, it would have ended up not looking like Kelly Jones and I'd have been disappointed probably.
Yeah.
Because it's a very difficult style to ape.
Mm.
So I think they probably did make the right decision to go for a different look. Mm. But I personally would have preferred a more impressionistic or a more artistic rather than a trying to look real.
Mm.
Because I think by trying to look real, they failed because it's almost real but not quite. And that's that Uncanny Valley thing.
Yeah.
Which at times for me creeped me out and took me out of the story. Now that's a personal thing and I'm sure very few people will have that.
Okay. Yeah.
I think it would have been more successful if they'd done it more cartoony as such. Yeah. If it was more expressive or expressionistic. Oh,
hello.
There's my phone making a big noise. I think it would have worked if it had been more impressionistic.
Yeah.
More stylized in a way. But I did enjoy it. I thought the performances were great. I did feel some of the voices were not what I had in my head.
No.
But that's a problem of listening to it 32 years ago.
I think there is that thing that when... So there's a British comedian called Joe Lycett who's very distinctive for us because he's got a Brummy accent and he's quite camp. So when you have him in there...
Yeah, he did one line of dialogue, didn't they? And I was just like, that's Joe Lycett.
So, you know, that kind of took you slightly out of the story. But that's not because it's Joe Lycett. I just think it's...
And I think that would happen anyway. If you know the voices... I mean, I didn't recognise Sandra Oh's voice. I've not watched the big TV show she's done. I know she's hugely well known for Killing Eve.
And then
didn't recognise her voice.
That's the same thing, and that's the same thing in sort of like in the next story. That was obviously Derek Jacobi. But then what do you that's always the danger, isn't it, with those things when you recognise someone,
an actor, and I think in animation you will always recognize, there will be people who watch that who'll be like, oh, that's Sandra Oh.
But for a lot of British
people, very quickly, because she's a good actress and the story's good, I think you lose that.
But for people outside of the UK,
Sandra Oh is kind of international,
there were a lot of British people in there,
there were, and doing a very good job, actually, I thought. The voice acting was very good.
Mm.
It wasn't what I had in my head. And some of it was
as
simple as...
That's always difficult, isn't it, with art?
Yeah, and with a book to a...
Mm. Yeah.
And again, because it's a comic to animation, really the voice is the main difference between the two.
Mm.
So in a way, the changes in my head, that changes from what I had in my head... seem faster than in the ones where they've made it a live action. Because you're like, well, of course live action's going to look different to a comic. But when it's animation to comic, I almost feel like there's a bit of my brain that's going, well, this should be more similar. And it can't be, you know. And I think I said last night, in my head, the kind of matriarch, you know, the woman who'd lost her kids and the cat who was telling the story, in my head it was kind of like a Maya Angelou kind of voice.
Yeah, not a... Yeah, and maybe.
Sandro has a very different kind of voice. She's very confident sounding. She's
soft.
She's softer, but she's also... She has got that kind of power and confidence. And at first I was like, oh, that's not the voice I expected, but then I got into it.
But then do you think that was a choice? Because the Sandman cat did have the voice that I would expect from the Sandman cat.
Well, it was the Sandman's voice.
Because it was the Sandman.
It was Tom Sturridge.
So the female cat had to be a kind of voice difference between the two, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. And maybe having a deeper voice woman would have kind of been competitive against his voice,
yeah.
I suppose, is what you're thinking.
Yeah.
But for me, more so, it was...
He's got a... Yeah. He's got a deep voice, or he hasn't.
Yeah. I think what was important is that it was a voice that sounded confident.
Yeah.
But had empathy. You know, the story they're telling is about personal loss. But it's also got a confidence to communicate with a big group of cats. You know, the idea of a lonely kind of character travelling the world, telling a story, and trying to get every cat in the world to hear this story. You know, there's got to be an authority and a confidence and also an emotional quality. Which, you know, in my head for 30-odd years was that kind of Maya Angelou-y thing. But it works equally as well with Sandra Oh. I think she exudes a confidence and a competence.
The thing that got me, I think, and I don't know why, but I was expecting that if the cat had been travelling the world, etc., she'd be a bit more ragged, sort of like, and she still looked like... I would want her to look a bit like Mr. Bumble, a little bit dishevelled. But she looked like...
But she was pristine in the comic as well. My interpretation of that would be that she's kind of untouched by the world.
She's just
got this story to tell, so she's going everywhere, she's doing everything. But that's not touching her. What touched her was her own experience and her experience of the dream that she wants to share. And everything else kind of falls by. You know, it is that kind of prophet thing. I noticed in the credits, the character is credited as prophet. Which, in the comic, no names are given to any of the characters. And actually, there's not specifically... anywhere in the dialogue, any reference to the gender of the characters.
Okay.
So, you know, the kitten is shown in quite a frilly kind of cat bed, but it's never specifically mentioned as being female. The older cat is not specifically mentioned as being male.
No.
It's only the mother cat that's telling the story that obviously has to be a female. Again, you know, there was that initial, oh, they've gone female for the kitten, they've gone male for the... And maybe that was always Neil Gaiman's intention, and it was just never in the words in the book. But when I was analysing it for the podcast, I went in and looked for that. Can I say she? Can I say he? You know, when I'm doing a synopsis. Because it's easier. But I had to keep going, the kitten, the older cat, because they weren't gendered.
Do you think? I think one of the problems I have, sort of like, and maybe it's one of kind of Neil Gaiman's fortes as well, it's subtle, but it's not subtle, a lot of his work. I mean, you sort of like clearly the prophet cat is supposed to be, you know, sort of pick your prophet, Muhammad, Jesus, whatever.
I think it could even go more political or more, you know, you could take that prophet cat almost to be
sitting
like
on
Martin Luther King or, you know, even someone like a Greta Thunberg.
There
you know,
is
just somebody who's going out into the world and telling a story. Malala would be an example. You know, someone who's telling a personal story and how that affects the world and trying to get change.
His stuff isn't... I think, sort of, like, I think why people like him so much is because he doesn't tell you what to think. So he kind of gives you the idea, the kernel of the idea that, you know, the rising up, the dreaming is a good thing to do. But he doesn't necessarily, it's not kind of ideological. So you know, so it's not how to do it. It's just, this is...
Well, in some ways, this comes down to, you know, yesterday when I was kind of contrasting him with Alan Moore and the kind of political... ness or the politic of comics, particularly British creative comics in the 80s. Marvel and DC were pretty corporate, and that was one of the ways the British people stood out, because they came in, you know, and I think maybe because we have the BBC, maybe not, maybe it's not the BBC, but because we have this huge creator of content that is separate from financial considerations, separate from business, or at least was in the 80s more so, there's people come up in the UK expecting there to be politics in art. And I think in the 80s, I think a lot of American stuff was very much going, oh no, we're beyond politics now. It's just about business, which in itself is political. But I think that's where a lot of the British writers and artists stood out, is that they were trying to make a point. They were trying to say something. And we talked about how, you know, the politics was very pure politics. You know, it was, you know, demon yuppies who were trying to get Thatcher to win the election in Hellblazer. And, you know, that kind of thing was going on. And Neil Gaiman comes in and he's much softer and he's much more... just kind of, you know, he's talking about identity politics, but not about capital P party politics. And I think that was easier for people to accept.
Totally.
And easier to go more mainstream in a way, because the 80s as well, you know, and there were lots of backwards things in the 80s, you know. In Britain we had Section 28. I know, you know, the AIDS crisis was a huge, you know,
the smashing of the unions.
So. Yeah. There were things going on that were politically and were hurting marginalised people. Racism was rife, sexism was rife, even bigger than it is today, both of those things. But I think as well there was an opening out in attitudes in some ways. You know, and kind of people were getting more broadly open. I think that's how he became more popular.
Yeah.
But you're right, there is something political in there. But it's about dreaming, it's about ideas, the idea could be anything. The idea could be, you know, I can get people to join in my dream about green issues, or about, you know, this one's about, you know, the power dynamic between animals and humans. And, you know, I think there's a political point in there about animal rights, sorry, not human rights.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm trying to say, but I think right, it's very... soft and gentle, and it's not strident. You know, I think if Jamie Delano had written a book about this, it would have been, we all have to work together to destroy Thatcherism.
Yeah.
You know, and it would have been very blunt and very in your face. And that's an acceptable way to tell a story. But this is much gentler, much softer, much more... And also more poetic as well. It's more, you know, just the world can be changed is the moral of the story, I think. The world can be changed.
Okay.
By the smallest creature.
So I think we quite enjoyed it.
I did. I enjoyed the adaptation and I think it was good. And I think it brought out elements. I think watching it made me focus on things that I didn't focus on in the comic.
Yeah. And I like the sort of different, like, I mean, when she was travelling through different scapes and that sort of thing, I thought that was quite beautiful.
It was. I think, I think
that was.
But I thought that was a very beautiful part of the comic, which we didn't really talk about very much. But when she's on her track, we talked when we were talking about the comics. We were talking more about the cat, the use of cats and how beautifully drawn they were.
Mm.
But actually, those kind of landscapes that she was traversing across and how they were drawn, you know, really was beautifully done. You know, this the kind of sea of corpses. Well, it was bones, wasn't it? That she's kind of stalking through, which looks stunning on screen. And actually, you know, it's almost lifted exactly from the comic, just drawn in a different style because it's not Kelly Jones. But yeah, well, I really enjoyed it, actually. And I have really enjoyed Sandman in general. I think the changes have been good. And they've been justifiable. And I think... Actually, I hope it leads to there being more comics adaptations where the person who created the comic is involved, or at least people involved in it. Because I think the fact that it's the person who knows what the story's about is adapting it means that it's better than if it was just given to someone else. So, yes, normal question, should I love this comic? We already answered that, it's yes. We gave it a 39 out of 40, amazing comic. And should we love the adaptation?
Yeah.
Yes, also. I think, you know, I think you'd be very wise to
watch it.
Both read and watch this. So, yeah, that's it. We'll see you again in a few weeks, hopefully with another episode of Should I Love This Era?
Lovely.
Where we're back to looking at the Marvel comics from cover date November 1986 with the special border. And hopefully see you all on the internet soon. Don't forget you can always follow us on Twitter. I'm at Whiter Trash.
And I'm at Irrigale 32.
32, he's going to remember that one day. And you can also follow us on, if you follow our blog, which is shouldilovethis.blogspot.com, you can very easily see what we're doing. You can see information about the podcast and also see when we release a new one. So thank you very much. Speak to you all soon.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye bye.